You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, March 19th, 2008, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
And to all of our bird enthusiast friends out there, happy St. Joseph's Day.
Thank you.
St. Joseph a bird?
No, come on. Bird people, St. Joseph's Day. The day the swallows return to Capistrano in California.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, famous song.
Swallows.
Yay.
That's
and
fascinating.
Happy vernal equinox, everyone. Today's the last day of winter.
Yeah,
tomorrow will be the first day of spring.
Oh, finally.
Awesome. Oh. How did that sneak up on me? Awesome.
Finally. I know. I love the
first maybe day you didn't notice because it was snowing. Or is that just here in Boston?
Right today, there's no. It was raining down here.
I think it's turned into rain. It is. Okay, so it was snowing this morning. Now it's raining. Clearly, it's spring now.
Right.
God, I love Boston.
Just transitioned to spring. Yeah, there were about 20 American robins on my front lawn today. It's always
no
a sign
shit.
Of spring. Yep. They were looking for all the worms that were coming up, I guess, because it was raining.
So that's a big deal. Why?
Because that's a harbinger of spring, Jay.
That's right.
It's interesting. I always thought that robins migrated, but it turns out they're non-migratory. Mm. That the reason they disappear in the winter is they just hide out in the woods, and then they only come out into the open areas like lawns in the spring.
Did I just laugh at a word that I thought you made up at Israel?
Non-migratory?
That's a word?
That's the Monty Python pronunciation of migratory.
Okay, good. Because of last week, I don't trust any pronunciation that I think is correct.
Well, I hate to change the mood so abruptly, but we do have a sad bit of news to discuss today, an in memoriam. Arthur C. Clarke, a famed science fiction writer, passed away yesterday at the age of 90.
So sad. Famed science fiction writer and friend of Randy, we should mention.
He was an icon.
Yeah. As Perry would say, he had a good run.
Yeah, he had a good run. 90's pretty good.
Now, Steve, he had he was in poor health the last few years of his life, and he was confined to a wheelchair due to the effects of post-polio syndrome. Mm-hmm. Do you know what that is?
Yep.
What is post-polio syndrome?
Some people who get polio as a child, even if they recover very well from it, then later in life, decades later, they can have what's called post-polio syndrome, which is probably due to the fact that those neurons, those motor neurons that were infected with the polio virus, even though they may have survived, their lifespan was shortened, so they may die early. So decades later, you may start to have symptoms. And there also are other symptoms other than weakness. They may get some pain and muscle stiffness and tightness later on.
Well, he made it to 90, though, Bob. I mean, even if he was shaky for the last 5 years.
Yeah, that's still pretty good. And, you know, he wrote over 80 books, 500 essays. But, of course, what will he he's best known for? Of course, 2001, A Space Odyssey.
A classic.
Did you guys,
a
classic. Now, did you guys know that that story was based on a short story he wrote called The Sentinel in 1948, and it dealt with a highly advanced and enigmatic alien artifact found on the moon, of course, like the movie and the book. But he was friends with Kubrick, and they were working on some movie about humans and extraterrestrials, and Kubrick said, hey, let's base it on my story, The Sentinel. And so they actually both created, through this collaboration, the screenplay for the movie. Kubrick filmed it, and then Kubrick published a book just a few months after the debut of the movie.
Yeah, the book was based upon the screenplay for the movie. That's right.
Right. I wonder what kind of input Kubrick had, and how much was Clark and how much was Kubrick, but it's interesting that they actually worked on it together.
Well, I actually studied Stanley Kubrick's films in college, which was one of the best courses I ever took. And 2001 is my all-time single favorite movie. So if you understand the films of Stanley Kubrick, it's really easy to pick out those parts that you know are all him. You know,
right. That's true.
So a lot of the aspects of it, the absolute like crushing loneliness and isolation of space, was something that Kubrick was definitely going for. Interestingly, one of the few movies that gets it right space, in that noise. In space there is silence. Yeah. You know, there's no, you can't hear the ships whizzing by. It's utterly silent, and that movie's often credited being one of the few that actually got that little scientific detail
and
correct.
It's so eerie. But, it's so cold. It was.
But it was very deliberate on Kubrick's part. It may have been scientifically correct, but it was also that mood.
The mood
of
right.
complete isolation was what he was going.
And he got
for.
It.
Daisy.
I love that movie.
But there's one other thing about Clark that I wanted to talk about. I'm sure you guys have heard at some level that Arthur C. Clarke invented or predicted mm-hmm. satellites.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's what I've always thought. It's a little more complicated than that. He didn't actually come up with the idea of a geostationary orbit. That was actually thought of by Hermann Potasnik and Konstantin Tsiolkovsky. So that was thought by he wasn't original when it came to that, but he is the one who came up with the insight of linking groups of geostationary satellites together to create a global communication network.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he didn't just say, "Oh, isn't this a cool idea? Maybe I'll throw this in the story." He actually wrote a technical treatment on that. He also worked with the USA to develop spacecraft and launch systems for these satellites, and he addressed the United Nations during their deliberations on the peaceful uses of outer space. And mm-hmm. He received awards for this. So it's not just I used to think it was just a prediction that he made, but he actually was really involved. And actually, the International – I didn't know this either. The International Astronomical Union named the orbit, a geosynchronous orbit at 36,000 kilometers. It's called the Clark orbit. I didn't know that.
Cool. Very interesting.
And, of course, you guys know that he was a big-time skeptic. I mentioned earlier he was a friend of Randy's, but mm-hmm. also he had a great series on in mm-hmm. the 80s. It was called Mysterious World.
Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World,
Yeah, you can get it on DVD. I found it at the library like a couple years ago. And it deals with things like real-life zombies and cool stuff where Arthur C. Clarke travels around the world and investigates stuff.
You know, in all fairness, though, he did have, it seems, a few sacred cows that he clung dearly to. For instance, he wrote the foreword for a book called The Rebirth of Cold Fusion, describing how, in I quote him, "the neglect of cold fusion is one of the biggest scandals in the history of science." You know, and this was around the time of, you know, 1989 with the Pons and Fleischmann experiments on cold fusion, and you know, Clark certainly felt that the scientific community was ignoring what was going on with that experiment and other experiments like it around the world. And here's what else he had to say about it. He says the cold fusion controversy falls into the first category of failures of nerves. Many vital facts have been discovered, yet skeptics lack the courage to acknowledge them or their immense implications. So, and also there was mention of how Randy had to convince Arthur Clarke that the phenomenon of dowsing was, you know, nothing more than ideomotor effect and, you know, the other things that we know dowsing is to be. So he had his, he had many upsides, you know, and was a good skeptic in a lot of ways, but he still clung to a few things that, you know, I guess his fantasy part of his brain got the best of him when it came to certain things in reality.
Well, he ended it on a high note, though. CNN was reporting today that he had a completely secular funeral. He had specific instructions to do that. He said, "Absolutely no religious rites of any kind relating to any religious faith should be associated with my funeral."
Hmm.
So, sets a good example.
Well, he will be missed. Again, as I said, I think he was an icon. I do think he also shows that, in a lot of ways, some of the best science fiction writers were those who had a keen interest in science and knew the science and got it right. Like Isaac Asimov, of course, is the other name that pops up when you think about that. The next news item is a bit of a lighter item. This one was sent to us by a couple of our listeners, so thanks again for alerting us to these news items. We had spoken previously about Saudi Arabia being interested in investing a significant amount of money into a university and sort of promoting it as a university that would be have a great deal of academic freedom, et cetera. So this news item did catch my attention. It was reported by Memory TV, which I think is an Arab TV station, that a Saudi scholar Dr. Walid al-Rashoudi, claims that only about 50 to 60 people perished in the Jewish Holocaust. So essentially, he is a Holocaust denier. He says that the claims that are made for it were, you know, obviously grossly exaggerated, you know, 5 to 6 million pared down to 50 to 60. I don't know if he was, if that was hyperbole on his part, but certainly it was meant to minimize the Jewish Holocaust of World War II. And he said that, that they it was essentially a hoax that was used to blackmail the world, you know, into creating Israel.
Disgusting.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, wow. It's pretty naked anti-Semitism. But again, I thought it was an interesting follow-up to our previous discussion because, you know, the Saudis are promoting scholarship, and here is a prominent Saudi scholar who clearly is anything but. I mean, he has his ideology clearly has outweighed his scholarship on this issue.
We were talking about scholarship as far as science and advancement of science in the, you know, Middle East mm-hmm. universities and specifically the Saudi schools. I mean, this fellow is the head of the Department of Islamic Studies. You know, so I don't know. I mean, part of me says that, you know, I almost half expect something like this to come from a doctor from
yeah,
the...
Yeah, it is definitely know. Different, although, you know, there are some generic virtues of scholarship, and it doesn't necessarily matter what your discipline is. Honesty, for example, diligence, you know, getting the facts correct. It doesn't matter what your discipline is. Those we sort of expect the same scholarly standards, and this definitely sets a bad example. One wonders, you know, how much we can extrapolate this to other, you know, other scholars and what this says about, you know, their endeavors.
Where'd they come up with the figure 50 to 60 Jews?
Yeah, that's a good point, Jay.
You know, like, how do they even come up? Oh, let's see now. You know, I don't believe in the Holocaust, so they only killed, you know, 50 to 60 Jews. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, of course it's absurd. This is not to say that there aren't, you know, equally absurd scholars in the United States or elsewhere, you know, spouting equally ridiculous things. But we are equal opportunity critics.
I think that's fair to say.
But speaking of terrible scholarship, I was listening to the Intelligent Design the Future podcast.
Ugh, why?
Oh boy,
torturing yourself?
Yeah, I don't usually listen to it because it is torture.
I ignore that podcast.
I was alerted to it by, again, some of our diligent listeners because the last couple of episodes they attacked me personally. So it's, you know, I'd like to take a listen and see what they're saying.
That's always
they interviewed
fun, though.
Dr. Michael Egnor on the current and last episodes of that podcast. This is a intelligent design propaganda podcast put out by the Discovery Institute. And Michael Egnor is a neurosurgeon who has been writing on their blog and has been, you know, working to promote intelligent design. And I've been sparring with him, you know, with the neurological blog and the Discovery Institute blog over the last 6 months or so, initially about intelligent design, because he's just said some incredibly absurd things, and then about dualism, you know, the notion that, you know, can the mind be explained entirely by the physical properties of the brain, or do we have to add some kind of ghost or magic in order to explain the phenomenon of mind?
So what does he think?
Well, he's a dualist. He thinks that the brain is insufficient to explain mental functioning and that we have to add something else.
And he's a neurosurgeon.
He's a neurosurgeon, right. And that is incredible, seriously. And it just shows, I think, you know, if you're ideologically bound, right. You know, you could twist yourself up in logic.
Compartmentalize.
The specific points that he was discussing on the podcast was the fact that in our exchanges, I made the comment that if you look at all of the predictions that flow from the materialist hypothesis of the mind, the hypothesis that the mind is entirely caused by the brain, if you look at that hypothesis and say, what predictions flow from that? And we're talking about, and I actually specified predictions that deal with just whether or not that is true, not all of the implications of it or all the minute details, just is the mind caused by the brain. And I listed them. I was very specific. I said, if this is true, then, for example, then there is no mind without a functioning brain. That if you damage the brain, you damage the mind. As the brain develops, the mind will develop. As you alter brain function pretty much in any way, that will correlate with altered mind function. And my point was that all of those predictions, every single prediction that flows from the materialist hypothesis, has turned out to be true. And that there aren't any predictions that have not yet been essentially validated by neuroscience. Now, he jumped on my statement that all of the predictions of materialism have been true and is trying to portray that as being extreme and absolute. And I mean, he really, it's really, yeah, and dogmatic. It's really absurd. And he had to, I think, deliberately misunderstand what I said. He wrote, you know, a blog response to it, and then I called him out because he misquoted me. He left out he quoted me and then specifically left out the one piece that is critical to the point that I was making, and that is with regard to all of the claims that bear upon the truth, you know, whether or not the materialist hypothesis is true, just that bear upon the truth of that or not. Not every single, you know, sub-prediction that could be made. And he left it out. And I said, yep, there you go. You misquoted me and you missed the point. And actually, the point I was making is a critical one because I was discussing the strategies of denialists and I was making a correlation between evolution denial, like intelligent designers, and neuroscience denial. People, the dualists are now engaging in neuroscience denial in which they're denying the evidence for the brain causing the mind in the same way that evolution deniers and intelligent designers deny the evidence that evolution caused the diversity of life. They use a lot of the same intellectual strategies. One of those strategies is that they confuse the different levels of scientific knowledge. In other words, there's a sort of a basic level of knowledge, like did life evolve, or you know, is the mind a manifestation of brain function, and there's facts and information and logic that has to bear at that level. Then, of course, there's always deeper and deeper and deeper levels. How does evolution work? How does the brain work exactly? And you know, and you can get deeper and deeper. And what they do is they point to the fact that our knowledge is not infinitely deep and say that that calls into question the most top superficial level. Layer of knowledge, right? So it's the God of the gaps type of argument, right? We haven't fleshed out every last little detail of the immune system and how it evolved on a molecular level. Therefore, evolution didn't happen. Or we don't know exactly, you know, how neuronal function, you know, generates the or manifests itself as our subjective experience. Therefore, we don't know that it does. So he completely missed that point. I suspect he just doesn't get that. I think he doesn't understand it. I think he just doesn't have the logic necessary to understand what I was talking about. But then he misquoted me, glossing over the important bit. But here's the thing that's indefensible, is I called him on it on my blog, and I know he reads it because he responds to it. And now on the ID the Future podcast, he repeated the misquote. He quoted me again, leaving out the important details, and went even further in trying to characterize my position, to mischaracterize my position as being this like absolute extreme position. He actually said it was crazy, and I should be embarrassed to have stated it in public. That was how he characterized it.
Wow.
So now he's joined the ranks of the intelligent design and creationists who are intellectually dishonest and make a habit of taking quotes out of context in order to mischaracterize the position of the opposition. A lot of this is detailed in my blog, and I'm definitely due to summarize things. Because the other thing that he has done, looking back over our entire email, a blog exchange, is he's done the typical creationist dance of he makes a point, I utterly demolish his point. He comes back by shifting to another point without really ever addressing the fact that I've demolished his prior point. I then destroy his second point. He responds by shifting over to yet another point. And he just kept doing that. And I just want to document that process over the last 6 months because I think it's very revealing about how
you didn't expect him to be swayed by your arguments, and Steve, did you? I mean, did you really think you're going to win him over?
Well, I don't know. I mean, he's obviously a physician, a neurosurgeon, and it's quite possible he just might have some misconceptions, and that he would be reasonable and somebody who, you know, you could have a reasonable exchange with. But clearly, he isn't. I mean, if you read, and I'm not the only one who's been fighting with him in the blogosphere. He's also been crossing swords with, you know, P.Z. Myers and others, you know, more on the evolution issues. He's the guy who said, just to put things in perspective, and again, from a surgeon, through a neurosurgeon, I think this really puts it in perspective. He's the guy who said that if evolution were true, if natural selection were true, then we would expect that brain cancer would result in a better brain. Because
that
cancer...
That was him.
Because cancer cells are engaged in, you know, reproduction and natural selection. So why aren't they evolving into a more effective, higher functioning brain? I mean, that's the guy that we're dealing with. And clearly he's shown that he can't be educated on these points of logic or facts. Obviously, what's wrong with that, the logical fallacy there, is that cancer cells do evolve, but they evolve only purely for their own survival. And they do that really well, and that's why they kill the host usually, unless we kill it first. He's confusing different levels. Selective pressures acting at the level of the cancer cells are not going to be for the benefit of the overall organism. So clearly he doesn't understand evolution. It doesn't stop him from writing about it, though, you know, which again is typical of the ID crowd in general. So I'm sure that we will hear from him some more. I'm certainly not going to give up on this. It's been a very enlightening, I think, educational exchange for my readers, and also, you know, be updating our listeners on the podcast about it. One more quick news item, and this is another installment in our ongoing series on the dangers of belief in pseudoscience. And Bob, you sent me this one.
Yeah, the United Press International is reporting that in Katayam, India, where there were reports of an image of the Virgin Mary in the sky, that about 50 people have gone blind by staring at the sun.
You're not supposed to do that, by the way. Say that's a safety tip from Dr. Steve. Don't stare at the sun.
That's bad. Well, hopefully later on you'll see why it's bad.
Should I stick this fork in my eye? Is that okay?
Yeah, I recommend caution.
I don't want to kill the ghost in my brain.
This image is reported to be seen over the house of this mysterious hotel owner who's got some splaining to do. One hospital in the district, St. Joseph's ENT and Eye Hospital, has seen 48 cases of sight loss, apparently due to photochemical burns on the retina. Dr. Anima James Isaac, the hospital ophthalmologist, said the damage is to the macula, the most sensitive part of the retina. They have developed photochemical, not thermal, burns after continuously gazing at the sun. According to Dr. James Isaac, the patients show varying degrees of severity. They are mostly girls in the 12 to 26 age group. Our youngest patient is 12. The oldest is 60. Most of them were looking at the sun, he says, between 2 and 4 p.m. when UV1 and UV2 rays are harshest. He added that they could identify the problem as solar retinopathy because they were aware of the local sensation that was going on. Most patients may hopefully improve their vision, which is good, but there may be long-term effects on the retina. Churches, this is a good one, churches are warning their congregations that looking at the sun can cause permanent blindness, and have told them the supposed miracle is not one. Now, how often do you hear a church disavowing a miracle? That doesn't happen very often. The mysterious hotel owner, in the many articles I read, he was not named at all. He apparently moved out of his house. Apparently, he also claimed in the past to have statues of the Virgin Mary that cried honey and bled oils and perfumes.
So, all stuff you could pick up at your local store, by coincidence.
Yeah, right. Believer, and of course at the end here, this is too bad. Believers are allegedly still flocking to the hotel owner's house where the divine image is said to have appeared.
Mm-hmm. You know, whenever a statue or anything fluid comes out of it of any kind, the reason why I love these is you know 100% for certain that the people are full of it because they're putting it there. You know what
I mean? Somebody in there is committing fraud.
Yeah.
And as Joe Nickel always points out, it's always the simplest thing. There's no tubes running up or, you know, how does the oil get on the statue? Somebody just put it there, you know, when you weren't looking.
That's it. I wish there was more information on more information about the actual image of Mary above his house, but and why, you know, if it's in the sky, that's one thing, but I guess they thought it was in the sun. I don't know. It's unbelievable that they think they could be looking at the sun.
Well, there are known optical illusions, like from staring, you know, in the direction of the sun. You know, and that, like, it's probable that the mass visions of the Virgin Mary,
right,
at Fatima, you know, which was triggered by the reports of two young kids who said that they, you know, ran across the Virgin in the field or something, that was probably this kind of solar optical illusion.
Another factor is this is when as your retina is being damaged, you don't have any pain nerves in your retina, so it doesn't really hurt. So you don't even know, you don't even realize you're doing this damage.
Well, typically, though, the brightness will make you squint.
Right, the brightness, right, absolutely.
But there's no real,
like, stabbing pain as your retina is being destroyed.
Well, the retinal, like, damage doesn't cause pain, but the bright light does cause pain that is meant to be protective.
Right.
Let's go on to some of your questions and emails. The first one is a follow-up from last week. This one comes from Joe in New York, and Joe writes, "Hi, guys. Just listening to the latest podcast, and I want to respond to a comment that was made by Rebecca regarding Mormons and Boy Scouts. Rebecca's comment that Mormons control the Boy Scouts is a gross generalization. I want to state that while I am a skeptic, I am not an atheist. I think that science proves the existence of God rather than disproves it. But just to be clear, I am not a creationist. The fact of the matter is that the Boy Scouts is not a Mormon organization. What Rebecca is referring to is that apparently the Mormon Church has endorsed the Boy Scout program as the official youth program on their organization. While this may give them undue political influence on the state and or national level, it is factually inaccurate to state that the Mormons control the Boy Scouts. Just wanted to present the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, as you do every week on your show. Thanks, Joe." Now, Rebecca, you had several of these very pointed emails essentially making the
same
criticism.
And the funny thing is everybody thinks that they have the truth. And they don't.
Well, give us
but
the
you
follow.
Do.
Okay. Well, first of all, I was not referring to the fact that the Mormons make the Boy Scouts their official scout organization, which they do. It's true. But when I casually mentioned that the Mormons control the Boy Scouts, I apologize if people took that literally. The Mormons do not officially head up the Boy Scouts. In fact, the Mormons control about 30% of the total number of Boy Scout units. You see, because the way it works is each unit across the country has a sponsor. And the Mormons happen to be the largest sponsor of any other organization. And just to follow up and make sure that I had all my facts straight on that, I contacted Patrick Boyle, who's the editor of Youth Today at youthtoday.org and the author of Scouts Honor Sexual Abuse in America's Most Trusted Institution, because he has written quite a bit about the Boy Scouts and a bit about their religious connections too, because it's not just the Mormons. The Mormons do have the largest stake in the Boy Scouts, but the next largest, I think, is the Methodist Church, way below the Mormons, but they are number two. Patrick was kind enough to get back to me with a few interesting facts. For instance, in a case that that was very prominent about 10 years ago, I suppose, Boy Scouts of America versus Dale, which was the gay scoutmaster case that went to the U.S. Supreme Court. The Mormon Church filed a friend of the court brief along with several other religious denominations. And according to Patrick, page 3 of that brief says, "The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints sponsors over 400,000 scouts and over 30,000 scouting units nationwide, making it the largest single sponsor of Scouting United in the United States." And the brief also says, "The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints would withdraw from scouting if it were compelled to accept openly homosexual scout leaders."
LDS was leveraging its sponsorship of the majority or the plurality of troops.
Exactly.
In order to influence, you know, these kinds of decisions.
That's what that means. They would withdraw from scouting, meaning that they would take their funding and all of their troops and go home.
Right.
Patrick says, more than any other factor, the close relationship between the BSA, the Boy Scouts, and religious organizations like the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints explains why the BSA pursued its anti-gay policy all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. It also explains why the BSA stands alone among Boy Scout organizations around the world and among other youth-serving organizations, including the Girl Scouts, Big Brothers Big Sisters, and the Boys and Girls Clubs of America in barring homosexuals.
Mm-hmm.
One other thing, the Mormons make no bones about the fact that they are in bed with the Boy Scouts of America. On their site, they say, the BSA is a private organization, the same as the Red Cross, but it is influenced by the Mormon Church nationally. The general primary president sits on its board. Mm-hmm. It's safe to say that the top level has buy-in. They are part of its guts, so to say. There's a new website operated by the LDS BSA Relations Division in the church that attests to this fact. And they actually do have a website specifically for that, encouraging Mormons to take leadership roles in the Boy Scouts of America. So, I mean, the influence that the Mormons have over the Boy Scouts is pretty obvious to pretty much every party involved. It's very easy to find if you go online. So when I said that the Boy Scouts were controlled by the Mormons, that's what I meant. So I hope that clears things up.
Well, thank you, Rebecca. But yeah, it's and you we were chatting about this on email. You were taken aback by the fact of how emotional some of the response was, and my observation.
Like
you just never know when you're going to push buttons. You know,
of all the ridiculous things we say every week, that one really upset people.
Well, remember the milk we spoke about? Milk and that. Oh man, that unleashed a barrage against us. Jeez,
milk is a very touchy
the
topic.
The milk thing. Oh, the milk thing.
Don't get me started on milk. The next email comes from Jeremy Friche from Edmonton, Canada, and Jeremy writes, "Hi there. My wife was purchasing some facial cleansing products at a local drugstore, and while she was checking out, the saleswoman threw in some sample products for me. I'm a guy. She then told me that I shouldn't wash my face with soap, that the same scummy, scaly deposit left on the shower walls were being left on my face every time I wash with soap. And of course, the only way to prevent this from happening was to purchase expensive products specially formulated for male skin. Help me, skeptics. Is it true? Am I at risk of becoming a scaly crust face if I continue to wash my face with just soap?" This is kind of a fun one. I mean, cosmetics is so ripe for marketing pseudoscience and just made up claims that, you know, maybe, you know, have a little bit of a kernel of plausibility, but are just really designed to scare people into buying your expensive, you know, their expensive products. I could not find any legitimacy to this claim at all, and it runs counter to my understanding of how soap works. I mean, essentially what soap is, it's a long molecule, and at one end is a so-called hydrophobic end, a hydrophobic group, meaning that it does not like water, but it will cling to dirt and oil and things like that. And at the other end is a hydrophilic component, so that will bind with water, or at least it's friendly to water, right? So the oil and dirt loving end will bind up the oil and dirt on your skin, and then when you rinse it, the water will grab onto the hydrophilic end and wash it away. That's why soap is soap. That's why it works. So it's designed to be washed away with water. That's what it does. It doesn't stick to your skin. If you're developing stuff on the shower walls, it's because you're not washing it down thoroughly. Or a lot of that is just minerals from the water. It's just mineralization from hard water. It has nothing to do with the soap itself. If you actually rinse off your skin, you'll be getting all the soap away.
Plus, you know, the other obvious thing is that 99% of the population isn't walking around with giant soap flakes hanging off their face.
Or looking like the inside of a dirty shower stall.
The solution to this problem is not to change your soap, but to start making shower doors out of human skin.
There you go. But
maybe the point is don't go cosmetic shopping with your wife.
Yeah, I kind of have don't ask, don't tell policy with my wife. I've sort of given up trying to keep her from buying expensive cosmetic products a long time ago.
Really? Sounds like we need a little intervention.
Wait, Steve, but don't say that there isn't a quality difference between some cosmetic products and...
There isn't a quality difference between some cosmetic products.
You know what? There really isn't. Speaking as a skeptical female...
What about moisturizers?
Really not that big of a
Jay, I mean, all right, think about it this way. And you have, this applies to cleansers and pretty much anything. How many molecules are out there? Right? How many agents?
Six, seven.
Four and
stuff
and a half.
That does stuff, right? I mean,
yeah. Stuff
chemists,
that does stuff.
Chemists pretty much know the space of chemistry that's out there.
Yeah.
Actually coming up with a novel molecule that has some really, you know, again, some new or superior qualities to it would be a huge breakthrough. Cleansing agents all have the same basic kinds of stuff in there. And then they're just messing around with the filler, the dye, the color, the scent. Either there's some kind of bleach in there or there's some kind of, you know, acidic, you know, compound in there or whatever. And with cleaners, it's the same thing. There's either some kind of moisturizer in there or there's some kind of astringent or there is some kind of a soap. And that's it. You know, there's everything else is BS. It's just marketing.
If you go to Skeptic, we had a discussion about this exact thing just last week. My good friend and Skeptic writer Tracy was posting about how she just bought a really expensive moisturizer and loves it, and it's doing wonders. And eventually figured out that it's because the stuff costs so much that she has to use it every day or she worries that she wasted it, as opposed to the cheap stuff she could get at the drugstore that she just kind of lets sit there and doesn't really use. And the comments that followed that post were really interesting because a lot of people with some knowledge on the subject chimed in with exactly what ingredients are in moisturizers and how you can get the best value for the money.
Right.
So. Well, let me ask you guys a bunch of questions that the average person probably doesn't have the answer to. Like, one, can't there be other things or chemicals or whatever in a moisturizer that would work better or that would help your skin in a different way? I mean, I noticed
actual improved technology.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, my point is that that's actually few and far between, and that's rare. Those kind of innovations in the industry. The thing is, Jay, if that cropped up, everyone would just copy it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What's the claim of one product, one brand, that having actual superiority in its function? You know, maybe if there's more expensive ingredients in there, that might justify a greater expense, or if the manufacturing process is more sophisticated. You know, so there may be a little bit of difference as far as that's concerned. There may be less filler or whatever. There may be actual more active stuff in there. So there may be some basic manufacturing quality, but not enough to justify the difference between, you know, a couple of dollars for a basic product at a pharmacy and hundreds of dollars for some high-end brand name stuff at the boutique. I mean, that... there's nothing to justify that kind of differential.
Let me throw in a really silly anecdote real quick. I remember, it was probably like 10, 15 years ago, watching TV and Irish Spring, this commercial would come on and they kept saying, you know, leaves no residue behind and your skin is really smooth and all this stuff. And I remember I was vacationing and I was at a friend's house and they had Irish Spring and I used it in the shower. And I remember running my hand over my forearm and going, wow, it's 100% opposite. My hand was having a hard time rubbing my own skin because it was like sticking to my skin. I'm like, so that soap sucks, in my opinion. But the soap that I use, I like. There is a difference.
What do you use, Dove?
So there is a difference.
Yeah, but not in the soap. Again, the soap technology has been around for a long time, and it's basically the same thing. It's that long molecule, hydrophobic, hydrophilic, that's it. Everything else is filler, scent, the milling, the manufacturing, but you know, not actual different chemical technology.
Let me read to you from Tracy's blog entry. One of the commenters, because this is interesting, he says most facial creams consist of salicylic acid, glycolic acid, alcohol, a jellied agent, a fragrance, and a bunch of almost completely useless for the purpose of skincare things. Mm-hmm. Salicylic and glycolic acid are the key ingredients. Salicylic opens pores, and glycolic acid eats away at dead skin. Dermatologists use a high concentration of glycolic acid to perform a chemical peel. Knowing that you Knowing that, you could just go to any pharmacy, buy a 2% salicylic acid solution and a 10% glycolic acid solution, and use them to get the exact same effect as your expensive cream for a fraction of the price. That was from Jack on the Skeptic blog.
So, okay, that, you know, that makes sense, Steve. So, to summarize, the quality difference boils down to the other stuff, not the actual soap ingredient and not the actual...
Not the active ingredients.
Yeah.
Right. So, and that's really what matters the most. Joining me now is Dr. Stephen Barrett. Dr. Barrett, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you.
And Dr. Barrett runs the consumer education website quackwatch.org. He is a retired psychiatrist and has been a tireless foe of health fraud and quackery for many years. So, Dr. Barrett, tell me, how and why did you get involved with the anti-health fraud movement?
Back in the late 1960s, I read some books that got me irritated, and by sheer luck happened to come across some other people who had similar feelings. We started a local discussion group that would meet for lunch, gradually formed a nonprofit corporation, and a network grew up that wound up going all over the country. This led to the formation of the National Council Against Health Fraud, and my scope became national.
And you're the vice president of that organization, correct?
Yes. I primarily operate as a Quack Watch, which is the current name of the original nonprofit corporation.
And, you know, we've referred to your website many times before, but again, for listeners who haven't heard of it, the Quack Watch is essentially one-stop shopping for information on any questionable or dubious or fraudulent health claims. So you must put a great deal of time into that project now. That's pretty much your major activity, correct?
That's right. I call it my default activity. If if there are no requests from my wife or a family or exercise time or other personal things, I spend most of my time either investigating or working on the website.
One recent one that you sent me has to do with a Medscape review article. And a Medscape is information for consumers and for physicians. It's, again, supposed to be a significant resource for health information. And tell us about that. Now, this was an entry reviewing acupuncture, which you took exception to.
One of the things I do when I see basically good websites that have occasional bad information is write to them with the hope that they'll do something about it. Earlier this week, I discovered that there was a complimentary piece on Medscape about so-called integrative medicine and a book about it. And I wrote to the editors of Medscape and complained that what they had put on the site was completely misleading. For one thing, the author of the book claimed that the Cochrane Collaboration, which does a great deal of a highly respected medical review, had come out and with many favorable reviews about acupuncture. I simply went to Cochrane, copied the links for some reviews which were unfavorable, and pointed out that the statement that Medscape had permitted to be published was just flat out wrong. I haven't received an answer yet.
Is that right? Yeah, I mean, I read through the information that you provided. I mean, they basically got the facts completely wrong. And, you know, how is it? So do you think that that's an overall quality control issue with Medscape, or do they have a blind spot when it comes to so-called integrative or complementary and alternative issues?
I would say that I think for the most part they're okay, but it's a large organization with items coming in from lots of different directions, and not everybody who's involved in the process is careful about excluding bad information. I've complained in the past, and many of the times what I've complained about has been removed. But there is a small lack of quality control when it comes to subjects like complementary and alternative medicine. However, they're much better than many other organizations. Mm-hmm. The typical medical journal, and some of the good ones have no quality control. Mm-hmm. The average medical throwaway publishes pretty much whatever it gets, and even the British Journal of Medicine has still has on its website some really bad articles.
And I find that although Medscape may be better than some, for most of these organizations that provide healthcare or medical information to the public, when they have a subsection or a section on, again, so-called complementary or alternative modalities, the quality control is completely different. There is this double standard where the promoters of alternative medicine could say almost anything they want, and there doesn't seem to be much of a filter there.
I have found that no large organization ever gets it right. None. Some of the better organizations don't have anything. But once they begin to have something, they always have something that's wrong. The same thing is true with the journals that tend to stay away from the subject tend to be okay, but once they start to get into it, I mean, Annals of Internal Medicine had a series and it was just trash. I sent a detailed analysis of one of the articles to the editor. I used to be a peer reviewer for them. They changed editors and they haven't used me, but I was the one who did most of the reviewing for offbeat types of articles. Mm-hmm. After I left, they began publishing them, and I sent the editor one example of an article where there were more than 30 factual errors in the published article, mm-hmm. and he didn't care.
Yeah.
He said, well, okay, in the future I'll consult you, but I haven't heard anything. I don't think that most editors even care.
And it also seems like they're putting the fox in charge of the hen house. You know, they just let those who are promoters of alternative medicine deal with it. And I know you have encountered this before. We've encountered this. When we try to provide more scientific or objective information, we're the ones who get branded as ideologues. You've encountered that?
Well, what else can they say?
Right.
You know, the standard defense against anyone who criticizes them is that you're biased and closed-minded, but the fact is that closed-minded means you don't change your views with new evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, that's typical of the people who promote the so-called alternative and complementary medicine. Generally, once anything's out there, it's going to stay there forever unless the promoters die.
Now, in speaking of criticism, you know, doing what you do, you have been very prominent. You know, Quackwatch has certainly put you on the front lines of this conflict between science, you know, trying to maintain the scientific standards in medicine and those who I think are seeking to erode it. And that has led to even some personal attacks that you've had to deal with. As you say, what else do those that you criticize have to say but try to attack your motives or you personally? What kind of personal cost has that had for you? And do you think, looking back on it all, do you think it's been worth it?
Well, I certainly think that my anti-quackery effort has been worth it. I mean, it's quite clear that I've helped tens of thousands of people. I get messages almost every day from people thanking me for helping them decide what to do or get rid of their quack. Or
right.
As far as the attacks on me, they've gone beyond. They're not just name-calling. I mean, they're just people just make things up. I mean, one guy has been running a campaign now for many years to suggest that I had my license taken away. All I did was retire, and he's fully aware of it. And furthermore, I have a license, but that doesn't make any difference. He keeps on calling me de-licensed. I'm suing him. You talk about cost. I've had some legal expense because of the fact that I'm suing people for libel in the hope of getting rid of some of the misinformation that's been floating around.
The purpose of it, obviously, part of it is just to ruin your reputation, to sort of take the wind out of your sails, to take away from your criticisms, but also just to use up your time and resources and distract you from doing the work that you're trying to do.
Yeah, there's also an effort to try to cut off my income. Mm-hmm. Not that they know anything about where it comes from or if I have any, but there's an effort made to interfere with my ability to function as a consultant and expert in court and other things like that by spreading misinformation. I have evidence that, for example, when I was going to appear when I was involved in a court case, false information was given to the opposing lawyers, which they hoped to introduce.
So, you know, for our listeners, I mean, there's just so many topics. So what are some of the most egregious frauds out there that you've come across? Are there any, you know, over the many years that you've been doing this, and I know they're all bad, but are there any that stick out as, like, the most fantastic frauds?
It depends on what you want to measure. I would say that there are three that stand out as most dangerous. of those, there's chelation therapy, the intravenous infusion of a compound called EDTA with various vitamins and minerals, with the claim that it can clean out the blockage of your coronary arteries, or it can cure autistic children. The fraud involved is, number one, expense. Number two, with respect to coronary artery disease, the promoters of chelation say that if you've been advised to have bypass surgery, you should see them instead. And so what happens is it's an invitation to die. I mean, people that need bypass are not going to benefit from chelation, and a certain percentage of them, if they don't have the operation, will have a heart attack, and some of them will die. So chelation is very, very bad and sufficiently widespread that it's my number one concern. Secondly, there's another one that's more widespread, not quite as dangerous, but still pretty nasty, and that is the claim that if you have silver fillings, amalgam fillings in your mouth, that they're poisoning you and you should have them taken out and replaced by some other material. That's pretty nasty because it's expensive, and every once in a while, someone that has fillings taken out will lose teeth as a result. If you want to replace a filling, you have to drill a hole that's a little bit bigger than the one you're taking out. And so thousands of people every year wind up having amalgams taken out because there's a small group of dentists with extremely poor judgment who say, you're being poisoned by your fillings, take them out. The third dangerous item that I'm concerned about is a series of videotapes by Lorraine Day, who's a non-practicing orthopedic surgeon in California. And Day claims that she cured herself of breast cancer through a program of diet and prayer and some others. She posted her biopsy report and some of her medical records on the internet and has a video that shows what she says is her breast with a large tumor, claiming that this was cancer and doctors sent her home to die. And she cured herself. Well, I don't believe her story. She did have cancer. I read the biopsy report. But she only put part of her records, and I got another piece of record that contradicts part of her story. And many people have asked her for the rest of her records that would show whether that large mass was a tumor. I think it's a cyst, and she had it surgically made smaller. And the idea that I don't think doctors sent her home to die, I think that's a cock and bull story. The reason I'm concerned is I've had at least a dozen credible reports from relatives of people who appear to have had their lives shortened by following her advice.
Now, in her particular case, I know we can't read minds, we can't always tell, but you know, where along the spectrum from true believer to just out-and-out fraud or con artist do you think her or, you know, or many people like her fall?
I think she's got fixed beliefs in incorrect ideas. I think she has an elaborate system of false beliefs that she believes. On the other hand, I think she's also conscious of lying. I think it's a combination.
Right.
I think people sometimes lie in order to protect their beliefs. In this case, when challenged to produce her records, her response is, you have no authority to get anything from me. That's a private matter. I mean, here's a woman who puts her naked breast on her website and puts it in her videos, but when somebody says, hey, I'd like to see the biopsy, I'd like to see the operative report when that breast was operated on, that suddenly becomes private. I can think of no other explanation other than that she knows that the records would show she's lying. I think she believes most of what she says.
Do you have any generic advice for healthcare consumers other than going to your website? I mean, in order to minimize the chance of being defrauded or being mistreated by somebody, again, a practitioner with bizarre fixed beliefs?
I think one of the key principles is you have to have the right level of skeptical belief. I mean, some people say, I don't trust anybody, I want to read all sides, then I'll figure out who's telling the truth. Those people always go wrong. Every single person who's ever said that to me, and I'm talking about hundreds, has wound up absorbing misinformation. You have to have the right level. You have to be able to place your trust and not think you can figure out everything for yourself. On the other hand, you have to be skeptical of information that you receive if it makes a lot of prominent claims. I mean, that's number one. Number two, you have to try to learn who to believe rather than sorting things out. Generally, government websites, the sites of the large voluntary organizations, large professional organizations, tend to be trustworthy. I recommend avoiding advice from any source, print, internet, or anything else that's involved in the sale of vitamins, minerals, dietary supplements, herbs, homeopathic remedies. If you're willing to avoid advice from anyone who has any connection with the sale of these products, you'll avoid 99.9% of the bad advice.
You've been doing this a lot longer than I have, and I like asking the question, what's your impression about how we've been doing with this over the last couple of decades? I mean, do you think things are getting – it seems to me that things are getting worse. If you take a long view of things, do you agree with that, or do you think there's, you know, any reason to be hopeful about all this?
I can give you a little historical perspective. I would say that in the 1950s and 1960s, the FDA had an extremely aggressive program of criminal prosecution and did a pretty good job, I think, of hitting the major scammers. Starting in the 1960s, with the rise of television, the reach of quackery became much greater, and the major talk shows promoted books, and the books in turn promoted nonsense. I would say not too much happened in the 70s. I would say that going through the 1980s, I think the press was pretty much on our side, that I think the general public got the idea that most people don't need to take vitamins and so on, and that generally speaking, the anti-quackery forces were prevalent in the neutral media. However, starting in the early 1990s, this changed dramatically with the creation at the National Institute of Health of an organization or a component that was to study complementary and alternative methods. And at the same time, Congress weakened the law by passing a bill in 1994 that would enable the sellers of dietary supplements and herbs to make a lot more claims than they used to be able to make. And I think the combination of that, plus the internet, plus a lot of not very sophisticated writers talking about how complementary and alternative methods are going to come into the mainstream and be researched more, and they're going to get sorted out. I think those three things coalesced to put us really in a golden age of quackery, and I think we've been there for about 10 years. Mm-hmm. As far as how we're doing, the critics, I would say that the internet is a two-edged sword. It enables people to widely promote whatever it is they're promoting. Mm-hmm. But it also gives the skeptics an opportunity to put out their views without interference. Getting skeptical views, for example, into a television program, on a talk show, widely distributed and so on, has always been difficult. And, I mean, people like Oprah, for example, I don't think Oprah has ever had anybody on with an opportunity to criticize quackery. Mm-hmm. Larry King has become one of the quack's best friends. He has somebody on quite frequently to promote some nonsense. I think he's having a former Playboy bunny to talk about her views about how immunization causes autism. I think Larry King is extraordinarily irresponsible. I don't know if he has a clue about what he's doing, but I don't think his producers want him to. So, but on the other hand, people who really want to get good information can go on the internet and find it now. Mm-hmm. I wish there were more comprehensive sites like QuackWatch, but the fact of the matter is that people find it. We're very fortunate in that almost all the subjects we cover, if you search for them, will pull up what we have very near the top. I'm amazed.
Yeah, I agree. I found the same thing, that you don't really necessarily have to have very, very broad exposure. You just need to get to the right people at the right time, the people who are looking for information because they're about to make a medical decision. So it's not as broad, but it's very targeted. And just to summarize what you said, you know, it seems to me that the frauds and quacks have been successful in rebranding unscientific, you know, again, fraudulent healthcare practices, rebranding it as complementary and alternative, or now integrative medicine, and that's been remarkably successful. And and I think you're right in producing this quote unquote golden age of health fraud.
Yeah, that's true, but it's even worse than. It's almost beyond imagination how bad it is, because they've been able to penetrate the medical schools. Mm-hmm. There are many, many medical schools that are teaching absolute garbage to their students. And the Student American Medical Association has embraced naturopathy.
Yeah.
Has put out statements and information on their website that promotes completely irrational methods. It's a sign that of how badly the medical schools are failing, teaching students to avoid irrational thought. The organization that does accrediting of continuing medical education is also permitting nonsense to be taught in accredited courses, and it's not done out of ignorance. I can tell you that I've met personally with the people who run that, in fact, at their invitation, and told them in no uncertain terms what they need to do with, and I can, and they've even had me spend days analyzing applications and then completely ignored what I said.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, since the Office of Alternative Medicine, now the National Center for Complementary Alternative Medicine, has been functioning, I don't think that they've added one lick to the overall medical literature, meaning that they have yet, after, what has it been now, 10 years, 15 years, and hundreds of millions of dollars spent, they have yet to definitively prove that any modality either works or doesn't work.
Exactly.
Which is the bottom line purpose of medical research, so we know what works and what doesn't work, and they haven't accomplished it in one case, in any case.
That's right.
So it's a monumental waste of time. But what it does do is provide legitimacy and cover for quackery.
Exactly.
Well, Dr. Barrett, thank you so much for joining us. It was a very enlightening interview. I hope to have you back sometime.
Okay.
And definitely keep up the good work at QuackWatch.
Oh, you too. Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real, one fake. And then I challenge my skeptics and our listeners to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week, giving you guys a break from themes recently. But we have a theme this week. These are all recent astronomical discoveries.
Okay.
Ready?
Yes.
Okay, item number one. Astronomers have discovered the most massive black hole yet known, with a mass of 18 billion suns. Item number two, astronomers have discovered water and organic molecules for the first time on a planet outside our own solar system. And item number three, astronomers reviewing images from the recent Messenger flyby have discovered evidence of recent tectonic activity on Mercury. Evan, start it off for us.
Okay. Mass of 18 billion suns, and that's a black hole? That's big. It's pretty big. I mean, I guess it'd be kind of hard to miss if it were that big. The next one was astronomers discovered water and organic molecules for the first time on a planet outside our solar system. Something's wrong, I think, with that one. I mean, maybe they discovered water. I think that's kind of inevitable that they'll discover water on other planets, but this organic molecules, I'm kind of puzzled as to what that is. And then they're reviewing the images of the Messenger flyby of Mercury, tectonic activity. Sure, it's probably the most plausible of the three. So I'll say the second one is fiction because I don't buy that organic molecules part.
Okay, Jay?
Well, I'll tell you what, Steve. I think I'm going to go with the black hole one just because you said that it has a mass of 18 billion suns, but suns can be such a variable size.
I'll give you the clarification there.
Solar mass.
There is a solar mass, and a solar mass is the mass of our sun.
Okay, so there's a black hole out there that is 18 billion solar masses. That is...
Right.
We're all dead. That thing is a monster.
Well, you know, could be 12 billion light years away.
So. Jay, it still has normal gravity. It doesn't reach out any further.
Bob, when it's your turn, it'll be your turn.
Sorry. Damn, Bob just got smacked.
But it's so big.
It's full of stars.
It's scary. Just think it up. All right. So anyway, astronomers have discovered the water and organic molecules. Like, sure. Okay. I totally buy that one. And astronomers review images from... you know what? The first one is fake. I don't believe in the black hole.
Okay. Rebecca?
Before I answer, I want to say that Mike, who runs SGU Fans... Everybody knows Mike. He emailed me the other day to say Hey, Rebecca, just wanted to give you the heads up that if you win the next Science or Fiction, you will tie Jay's 9-game winning streak record.
Wow.
So, you know, there's a lot of pressure.
Got a lot riding on this.
There really is. And I'm concerned about this one because I'm torn between two of them.
You're torn between two levels.
I am. You're going to say always. That. A massive black hole, 18 billion suns, that's officially an ass load, I think, of suns, but that is within the realm of possibility.
Having you say a massive black hole and an ass load in the same sentence is too much for me.
I apologize. I take it all back. It's more like a crap load. Is that better? So then discovering water outside our own solar system, I have not heard that. But it's definitely plausible. Recent tectonic activity on Mercury, I know that in the past, the very distant past, there's tectonic activity, but I don't think any's been discovered recently. So it's between those last two. And I'm not going to pull a Bob and do this all day. So, I'm going to go with, you know what? Normally, I would go with number two, but I think that that's the crazier of the two of those, and I think that Steve's trying to fool us. So I'm going to go with the tectonic activity on Mercury. I think that's fiction.
Okay, Bob, they're all over the place this week, so where are you going to come down?
Well, I don't have a problem with two, the water and organic molecules, but the other ones...
So what do you think of the black hole, Bob?
18 billion suns, is that like an order of magnitude bigger than... I thought the biggest were, you know, maybe hundreds of millions. 18, that just seems way, way too high. And three, they're discovering all sorts of new stuff with Mercury. But the recent... I would buy tectonic activity, but not recent tectonic activity.
Yeah, but wouldn't it be boring if Steve, like, it's not recent, it was a year ago, you know?
Oh, Jay, recent would be 10,000 years.
I'm just going to shut up, okay? Never mind.
I think.
I thought it was funny, Jay.
Tectonic activity.
There he goes, Rebecca.
So if it's tectonic.
Bob, why is this still funny activity. To me?
And he's off, ladies and gentlemen.
Is it because the music plays in your head?
Play the music. That means you've got tectonic plates, which means you'd have subsurface of magma.
Magma.
Could Mercury have a subsurface like that? Well, there could be radioactivity causing that, I guess. So I wouldn't know about that. I'm going to go with 18 billion suns. That just seems way too high.
Well, So Bob and Jay think that the 18 billion suns is too high. Shit. Evan, you are dubious about organic molecules. And Rebecca, you don't believe in the tectonic activity on Mercury.
We are all over
the place
this
week. Evan, let's deal with yours first.
No.
Astronomers have discovered water and organic molecules for the first time on a planet outside our solar system. That is science.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the organic molecule in question is largely methane.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I even read...
That's a big deal. Actually, that
I didn't even think of it like that. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, it is.
That's actually a big deal. Water is not so big, but methane is big. That's a precursor for
Phil made a fart joke about that today on his blog on bad astronomy.
Now, this is on a planet, HD189733b, which is a really sexy name, which is a hot Jupiter. It's a very big Jovian or Jupiter-sized planet that's very hot, very close to its star.
Closer than Mercury is.
Yes, it's very close. So it's too hot, really, to be a plausible location for life. So they're not thinking that this is a place where life might be. But methane is a kind of a big deal. I mean, it tells us that in that system are the precursors, of course, of organic molecules like amino acids, for example. and they found protein. This using a technique called spectroscopy, which is always amazes me that we can tell what stuff is made of, you know, halfway across the universe just by looking at the light that comes from it or passes through it. What a boon to science and astronomy that was.
We'd be nowhere without spectroscopy.
Yeah, my goodness.
Is that surprising, though, Steve?
No, it's not. I mean, the only thing is there's got to be something making the methane because methane usually reacts with stuff around it, and it won't last that long unless it's being renewed. That's why it's one of the possible signature chemicals for life. you know, like farting cows, right? You have some animal that's farting out methane, then that you would see that in its atmosphere, that would be a signature for life. There's got to be some, whatever, some chemical reaction going on this planet that's creating the methane, because this wouldn't last indefinitely. But what's interesting about this is that it's a proof of this technology, of this technique, and we could apply it now to other worlds that actually might be good candidates for life. So it's an important step. Let's go to Rebecca's item number 3.
Oh, man.
Astronomers reviewing images from the recent Messenger flyby have discovered evidence of recent tectonic activity on Mercury. Now, did either of you consider the effect, the solar tidal effects on Mercury and what that might be doing?
Oh, no. Yeah.
No.
No, well, smarty pants.
Well, that only would have misled you because this one was a fiction. This is the
ignorance
fiction
wins.
This is fiction.
Fiction.
So, I made this one up. There's no recent tectonic activity on Mercury because Mercury is small. It has hardened, you know, probably all the way down to the core. So there's no free-floating plates or anything that can cause tectonic activity. I couldn't find any evidence of any tectonic activity ever on Mercury. You know, so it's probably far enough back in Mercury's past that any evidence of it has been obliterated.
I'm pretty sure that Mercury has had tectonic
activity. It's had volcanic activity. It's had volcanic activity. And it may have had really distant tectonic activity, but I couldn't find anything that there's any evidence of it, and there's certainly nothing recent. And all the descriptions from NASA and et cetera of Mercury say there's no recent tectonic activity. So,
although I think they did find evidence that it shrunk a little bit at some point.
Yes, that's exactly right. As it cooled, it shrank, and that caused some rifts and ripples, but that's not evidence of tectonic activity. That's just shrinkage.
So Mercury had some shrinkage.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay.
Jay knows all about that.
All this means that there's a black hole out there that's 18 billion suns.
Yeah, it's right over there.
What the hell?
That
is. But more importantly, it means that I tied Jay's record. God.
That's true. That is more important.
Okay, so we're tied, but you have to get next week correct to beat me.
I mean, well done. Obviously.
This is technically what is called Fraggen Ginormis.
Fraggen.
Fraggen, yeah. Okay. It's 3.5 billion light years away. So it's nowhere near us. It's forming the heart of a quasar called OJ-287.
OJ?
OJ?
Yeah, no relation to the famous OJ. Now, this is by far the biggest black hole yet discovered. The next largest black hole has a mass of about 3 billion suns.
What happens if two black holes collide into each other?
They would combine and give off a huge gamma ray burst.
Gamma burst, yeah.
Well,
and make another incredible hole.
Yeah, but also some wicked gravity waves, too.
Mm-hmm. This single black hole has a mass equal to some galaxies. Imagine that.
Holy shit.
Mass of an entire galaxy.
18 billion? 18 billion suns would it be?
Right. A billion. That's right.
That's...
Now, what
you can't even conceptualize it.
Also, there is a smaller black hole that is gravitationally attached to this, and this is this is the strongest gravitational field we've ever seen, and this gives us great opportunities to test Einstein's general theory of relativity.
Well, localized gravitation.
It needs more testing.
Yeah, right.
So we got first. Okay,
the most localized gravitational field astronomical object. So. Yeah, so I'm sure our astronomers will have a lot of fun with this over the coming decades.
Well, you wouldn't even know when you pass through the event horizon. Well, that's true of all supermassive black holes.
We may end up as just a bunch of black holes, which will then evaporate away into nothing.
Evaporate?
That's beautiful.
Yeah, black holes evaporate.
Hawking radiation.
Hawking radiation, that's right. It takes a long time.
It takes a real long time, and then at the very end it blows up nicely. But it's just Hawking radiation. That's pretty much... proven. That's done.
And we don't know. We don't know if this is the biggest one. I mean,
it's the biggest yet discovered. That's all you could say.
No,
right?
I'm sure. Yeah. If we found this, I'm sure there could be one 40 billion suns, 40 solar mass, 40 billion solar masses.
Well, this thing's only getting bigger, and right now it's still gobbling up stuff around it. So it's
that thing goes through
a galaxy and it just sucks everything. It's like the Planet Eater in Star Trek. It just sucks. It's,
this is the Galaxy Eater.
Yeah.
Like Galactus. We talked about it.
There you go.
So if you're on a planet that gets eaten by a black hole, does it happen instantly?
No, it's not instant. You would think that it would be a, you know, zap and you're sucked in, but it would take a little time. It takes some time to suck up an entire planet.
And what kills you is the tidal forces. You get just stretched
apart. Oh, yeah. That's true.
Turn to spaghetti.
Okay.
Well done, Rebecca.
Thank you. Thank you. Very proud of myself.
Feels good to be up here. Right, Rebecca?
Yeah.
Took you
I'm
long
sad
enough.
That you're going to have to leave up here next week. It's just going to be me all by myself.
I have to be on my game next week. I got to give you a good one. I got three of you this week. I'm doing a little better.
That's it. That's
you
true.
You nearly got me.
And you, yeah, it was a tough one. I think the themes, for some reason, are a little bit more challenging.
I don't know about that, but let's
maybe
move on.
I need to stick more with the themes. Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
Yes, I do. It's a sad quote because it's an Arthur C. Clarke quote.
Of course.
I picked this one, obviously, because he just passed away, but also because I remember Bob telling me this quote probably about 20 years ago when we were watching a Star Trek episode together. And the quote is, "Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic."
That's one of his most famous quotes. It's a good one.
Arthur C. Clarke!
So, Jay, you remember me telling you that 20 years ago?
While we were watching Star Trek, I actually remember the episode.
And the chance of that memory being accurate is very remote.
Okay. Little
I hate to say you, hate to tell you that, Jay.
Whatever.
Let him have
Steve, I don't know, Steve.
No, Jay, Bob, the literature is absolutely clear on this.
I know.
The chance of that memory being accurate is very remote. Chances are you're merging memories.
I agree that's possible.
Shut up.
Who says what's wrong with that?
Jesus.
Just pointing that out.
Go ahead. Jay, you go right ahead and merge all the memories you want. Go ahead.
Jay, give us your fantasy.
Whether it's merged or fantasy, it's real to me.
Yeah, it's your own virtual reality.
It's in my head. It was this is why I know it's real. The memory's real. Because it was a Next Generation episode about these people, this alien that was using like the teleporter and all sorts of things that the Enterprise could do to pretend that it was a god on this planet, right? So then Jean-Luc Picard figured it out that there wasn't a god living on the planet and doing all this stuff and making things rumble and you know, zapping in and out. So he had he made himself come down and be a god too, with the power of the Enterprise behind him doing its stuff. And I remember Bob going, "This episode is about an Arthur C. Clarke, you know, quote." And he literally quoted it. So I remember. Bob, you remember that?
Vaguely.
Just but say
Bob,
yes.
It is your favorite.
No,
it is one of your favorite quotes, right?
Oh yeah, it's definitely a huge. That's probably his biggest quote of all time.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, it's definitely a cool quote, and lots of science geeks know it. But I don't know, Steve. I agree about memories and how fallible they are. But this one, I don't know. So you think this is a gist memory, a purely emotional memory, and the other one, declarative memory?
But basically, a detail memory, as opposed to a gist memory.
Right.
Well, I mean, the only thing that gives it plausibility is that the detail is in context. There's a Bob, the thing is,
the context
may be what's driving the details, right? Maybe you told him that quote a week later when he was telling you about the episode, and then he related it back to the episode.
That's possible.
And now he remembers you telling him during the episode. I mean, those are the things that you have absolutely no way to know if they're accurate or not. And in fact, your certitude is not a predictor of your accuracy.
That's true.
It doesn't matter how certain you think you are that you're correct. That does not predict the accuracy of your memory.
Yeah, that's true. That's all possible.
Those are just the facts.
I have to admit, after having this discussion about memory, I don't remember how long ago we went over this on the show. I remember thinking, because I remember like nightmares I had when I was a kid and stuff, and I remember just tripping out one day going, you know what, that those memories, even me remembering having those nightmares as a kid, may never have happened.
Yeah, yeah, may have been something somebody told you, that their nightmare, and then you imagined it, and then that became morphed into a memory of your nightmare. I mean, it's almost shocking how malleable our memories
it
are.
Is.
Actually, speaking of none of that, I have I do have an announcement. Well, one final plug for Boston Skeptics. Our first big event is Monday, March 24th. That's this Monday at 7 p.m. at the Asgard in Cambridge. Starts at 7 p.m. It's got Mike the Mad Biologist, Skeptics in the Pub. It's going to be a lot of fun. Mike's going to be talking about defending evolution. So, and it's free. So definitely please come if you're in the area.
Awesome. Well, thanks for joining me again this week.
Well, thanks, Steve.
Pleasure as always. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.